So today's day is going to be thinking about trauma-informed care, but I'm also going to put a heavy focus on resilience. So I'm hoping that you will come away with today with strategies for building resilience in yourself, for building resilience in your community and with your colleagues, and also for building resilience with the youth that you work with. So we're going to have kind of a dual-fold day. The morning and up until lunchtime, we're going to be really focusing in on the ACEs, thinking about the neuroscience, thinking about all the stuff that comes into the way we think about trauma-informed care. Then the afternoon, what I'm hoping to do is really focus on resiliency. So to give you guys lots of skills, to give you guys lots of ideas, to give you videos to use with your clients, to give you activities to use with your clients. I'm an experiential person, so you will be doing some of these things. You have always have an option to opt out. You're not going to be forced to do anything. And you always have an option to share. So anything that you're experiencing throughout the day, please stop me, please share any ideas, impressions. This is your training. So I don't have an agenda. My agenda is to serve you today and to be able to provide you with whatever you need. So I am always open to questions while I'm speaking. Do not feel like you have to wait till a question period. Please raise your hand, speak up, say something. I want this to be an open dialogue, and I want you to bring your experience and your struggles and your triumphs all into our training today, because I don't want me to be teaching to you all day. I want you to be part of this. I want us to do this collaboratively together. So a little bit about me. I am currently a trauma therapist. I work for the Resolution Group, so I work with children and adults, well, up to adulthood, and their parents that have experienced physical and sexual abuse. So I work kind of with some of the populations that you might be working with as they age out of the system, and also kind of at the beginning of their entrance into the system in terms of the care system. I have also worked in a whole range of settings. I've worked in youth projects, community-based settings. I've worked in adolescent inpatient units. I've worked with young carers, so children and teenagers that are caring for parents with mental health issues. I've also worked in schools. I've worked in youth advocacy. And so in a wide range of settings with a wide population of people. And most of my training I completed in London, and I worked in inner city London with at-risk populations with a really wide range of kind of cultural issues and needs. And one of the boroughs that I worked in, they spoke 200 different languages. So when we talk about diversity and spreading this, cross-culturally, I think that, you know, there is definitely an opportunity, and we need to keep that in mind as we think about how we gauge and pitch our work. I'm expressive arts trained. So a lot of the stuff that I will try and present to you today will have a multimedia component. We'll kind of tap into using different art forms. I do all 7 art forms, but I really like, especially with youth and kind of people that are aging out of the system and coming into adulthood, really using music, drama, visual presentation. So I think that we need to tap into their language. So I'll try and create and give you some tools. I'm also in constant dialogue with the tools that I use. So if there's something you don't like that we do, especially this afternoon, I'm going to open the floor for you to be able to give feedback on that. I did a training the other week and somebody was like, I don't like the voice of the person that did the meditation. Great. We need to have the same dialogue with everybody we're working with. What do you like about this? What do you don't like about this? So I'm going to open that up to you guys as well as we do this training. And then also, if you really don't like something, we'll come up with something else. So I'm flexible in that way too. I'm currently completed my top part of my doctorate, and I'm doing finishing my doctorate, but my dissertation topic is interoception in foster parents that look after children that have been sexually abused. So I have a strong interest in how we use the body to be able to regulate down to get into all those beautiful parts of higher functioning and emotion and brain and everything else. So some of the stuff I will pitch at you today will be body-based. You can choose whether you want to absorb that or not, but that's where the field is heading. Starting from the bottom, and working your way up instead of starting at the top and working your way down. And I think that you'll find that as we go through the material, especially this morning, you'll notice that a lot of the dysregulation is starting out in the body and is stored in the body. So how do we help create a safe environment to start releasing what's held in the body and start moving into those higher level functions?
It's also, I believe, why we see the most treatment resistance is because we go into worksheets, cognitive stuff, but we're not working with the body first. So I'd like to keep you to keep that in mind as we do the piece of work, as what that looks like as well. But before we get started, I know that we have people from different organizations and different roles, and I'm really excited about that. So I would love to just go around and everybody introduce themselves. I won't make you tell too much about yourself, just where you work, and if you want to share anything else about what you're hoping to get from today, great. If you don't want to, that's fine too. So I'll put you on the spot. You're in the front. I like my front row people.
I'm Josh. I'm a youth caseworker for the Y.
Okay, great.
I'm Betty Schoen, and I'm a transition specialist for Rehabilitation Services Administration, which is part of DES.
Okay.
And I work with the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, if you've ever heard of that.
No, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
We provide employment services for individuals with disabilities.
Great.
We start working with individuals at age 14. So,
oh, fabulous.
My colleague and I work with our high school population with disabilities.
Great, fantastic, welcome.
Jennifer Kelly, and ditto.
Okay.
Martha, I work with UMOM, DPYRC Center.
Okay, great.
Elena Steinbeis, and so I work with the YMCA as well. I'm a case manager, and I'm transitioning into specializing in aging out foster care.
Cool.
Mike Blanders, I'm with the YMCA as well.
I coordinate Reengage at Burton Bar, so I am a college access advisor, mm-hmm. and my overall title with the city is a case worker.
Great, welcome.
Hi, my name is Jane Pasendigo, and I'm with Arizona at Ward, Maricopa County, Youth Workforce Services, so I am a youth career guidance specialist.
Great. My name is Nadia Cisneros, and I'm with Friendly House, and I'm with the Parent Aid Services supervisor.
My name is Marissa Lomely. I also work with Friendly House and one of the parent aid supervisors as well.
Excellent. I'm from Friendly House as well, and my name is Sandra Valdez, and I'm the pre-employment services coordinator for youth with disabilities.
Great, welcome.
I'm Ruby Rocha. I'm a youth development coordinator with JSCS.
I'm Julie Jupp. I'm a youth development coordinator from JSCS as well.
Tanya Lopez, Neighborhood Ministries, workforce program coordinator.
I'm Susan Leon from Neighborhood Ministries. I do a program for teen moms and young parents.
Great.
I'm Irma Morales. I am youth care worker for UMOM. I'm working in the Transition Living Program.
Fantastic.
Hi, my name is Kumo, and I work with Opportunities for Youth as a recruitment specialist.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I go by E. I work for Rio Salado College, just one of the Maricopa community colleges. I work in our Community Development Division, and with our adult basic ed students that we have across six of our locations. So we start working with them at 16 in our program, individuals that need to learn English who have dropped out of high school.
Awesome, great.
My name is Mariela Gonzalez, and I work with Arizona at Work Maricopa County with the Workforce Services Program.
Hi, Kendall Brown, Administrative Coordinator, OFY.
Hi, my name is Rita, and I'm from Chicanos por la Causa, Program Manager for the WIOA Youth Program.
Hi, my name is Diana, and I work with Chicanos por la Causa as well. I'm the case manager, one of the case managers.
Fantastic.
Dominic Cota, I work with Chicanos por la Causa, Program Coordinator.
Hi, I'm Zara Gaeta. I'm an MSW intern at Arizona Center for Youth Resources.
Jenny Malachowski, Social Support Manager for Arizona Center for Youth Resources.
Director of Programs, ACYR.
Patrick Brown, Director of Education, same organization.
Great. Well, welcome everybody, and I'm so glad that you're here. As you mentioned before, the bathrooms are just outside here, water and coffee there. Feel free to get up at any time if you need to stretch, move, rehydrate, use the bathroom, anything you need to take care of, please feel free to do that during the session. We will take a break probably around 10:30, 10:45, and then we will break for lunch at 12 o'clock. We'll take an hour lunch, and then we'll take a short break also in the afternoon. My goal is to start wrap up around 3:45 and ask questions, and then we'll have time for questioning, and then at the if there's not a lot of questions, you will get out of here a little bit early. If there's lots of questions, then we'll answer all of them and make sure that everybody's questions are answered. But I know that the traffic going home will probably be as bad as the traffic coming here. So my goal is to work you through all this material and then to be able to get you out in a timely manner, because I know that the stuff we're going to be talking about is also quite heavy and there's a lot to absorb. So feel free. But everything is also in the PowerPoint that I gave you. Additional resources I'll be showing you, I will show you online so you can kind of jot down the information. I'll also show you my Pinterest pages that I make, and you're more than welcome if you're on Pinterest to join me as a follower. It doesn't mean you might get some random stuff with food that my kids like, but it'll be there and available for you. So I do make different boards. So I've just started a new account where I'm working on new boards. So I make boards for resilience, I'll make boards for affirmations, mantras, some of the things that I'll show you, meditation, stuff like that. I would encourage you to have a look. And even if you don't follow me, to just play around with it, because the resources are on Pinterest are amazing in terms of finding stuff to be able to use that are free, which we love, especially when we're working with clients and we have a budget. And then the other stuff I will show you will be, that it will be audiovisual, will be mostly from YouTube. So that way you can also access it for free. And I also make YouTube kind of, not boards, but folders that have different videos in them. So you should be able to access everything that I show you for the most part today for free and be able to use it with your clients. At least that's my hope. So let's get started. So my goal today is for everybody to have a better understanding of how trauma can impact health throughout life. So this is not only, you know, how trauma initially affects people in terms of our neurochemistry and our brain, but also how it affects us in the long term. And also to be able to then link that with what you might be seeing with people and clients that are coming into your services that have experienced early trauma or that have experienced trauma as they come into adulthood. Understanding the ACEs, which is the adverse youth or childhood experiences, and how that impacts people throughout life. Molly went to go get the full copy of the ACEs, the actual clinical scoring guide. When we kind of talk more about the ACEs, I will have everybody complete it. You do not have to share this information with anybody else. However, if you're pleased, astounded, disgusted with your score, and you do want to share about it, you're more than welcome to do that. Sometimes we don't realize how we score on this. The other reason why I will do that is because I want you to understand the experience of doing it. Sometimes we do things to our clients, or we ask our clients to do things, and we don't really think about how it impacts you. It's a short questionnaire. It's not many questions. But the stuff that it asks is deep. It could send somebody into a full flashback, full triggering of emotional material. So that's why I want us to kind of practice with these things. Tools for identifying and building resilience. So that will be our second kind of half of focus of the day. I will talk about the different ways that science is telling us we build resilience. The most amazing thing is that resilience can be 100% built and taught. So when we talk about being doomed and hardwired in a negative way, resilience is not one of those things. We can totally teach, build, harbor, nurture resilience in our clients and in ourselves. So I think that this is the happy, the light at the end of the storm is that resilience can be built, and you have an awesome opportunity to touch into building resilience with hopefully a little bit more of a developed frontal lobe. I get them where they're still developing their frontal lobe, so sometimes these resilience building things are just that little bit harder. But as we head into adulthood and we hit our kind of 20s, our frontal lobe's pretty much kind of at least close to all the way there. So you'll be able to tap into some really cool stuff that you can't necessarily do with little kids. And sometimes we think, oh man, I've got these older kids or these young adults and they're really hard to work with and they're already damaged and we got all this stuff going on. But the cool thing is that you have access to different parts of the brain that may not be developed in our little ones that we can work with, which is pretty cool. The other thing is that understanding what trauma-informed care looks like and how it can be applied to your organization. So I hope you'll get some ideas as to how to kind of frame your own thinking. And that's really where I feel that trauma-informed care starts, is with every one of you. It's not a protocol. It's not a document that says this is what we're going to do in our organization. It's really thinking about the way that you think and how you interact with the people that you're working with. And really changing your attitude. And when your attitude changes and that spreads throughout your work culture, then you will see the change towards trauma-informed care. And I think that's really important to think about. So a lot of times we talk about trauma, a lot of the old school thinking about trauma was very much about big events. So, you know, a flood, a disaster, a car accident, a fire. But we're really understanding trauma better with all of the technology that we have in terms of the way that it affects the brain and body. So trauma affects the central nervous system. And what it does is it creates an imbalance. So we're all born with a relatively balanced system. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're working with a client group that's had in utero substance exposure or where the mom has been involved in extreme stress or domestic violence during her pregnancy, that the system won't be a little off. So I wanna have that as kind of a predisposition. Also, everybody's system runs different. So if I think about my system versus somebody else's system, their way that their balance might look different than my balance. And that's just the way that we're kind of individually created and designed, and that's okay. So sometimes when we're administering or we're teaching an activity or an intervention, we need to think about where everybody's system's at. How is theirs different? And we need to work with them to identify that and to say, it's okay. It's okay that your window for what you can tolerate is this big and mine is this big, but I'm going to think about the fact that yours is this big right now and how we work with that. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And so what we want to do in our work with trauma is to really balance out the nervous system. So we want to take the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the one that does all the calming and relaxing, and then we want to take the sympathetic nervous system and we want to get them in balance where they can work together. And so that's when all of the good stuff happens. That's when we can get into our frontal lobes to do that good thinking and that planning ahead and the logic and the impulse control and all the stuff that we're hoping that everybody we work with kind of builds as a skill. But when it gets out of balance, we have to work with them to get it back in balance. And that's really when I talk about the body-brain kind of thing. So we have to activate and teach them skills to self-correct. We have to teach them that they are capable of self-healing, that this is possible, that they do not have to live in this body where their brain is getting hijacked all the time, that they have a ability to be able to have more control on this than they ever thought. A lot of people feel very out of control when they've experienced trauma in terms of what their body and brain are doing to them. And it creates that system of always living in threat, in danger. And what we want to do is to kind of scale that down so that they can be able to live the way that we would like to live. And what happens also is that our system, when it's out of whack, corrects itself. Well, how does it correct itself? By creating a bunch of adaptive and mitigating processes. And I'll go through a list of what these look like, but everything that your client is doing behaviorally that looks maladaptive is actually adaptive to their system. So that's an important thing to think about. These things that they have developed are coping strategies to be able to survive. They're ways to keep their system what they think is safe. And so that's an important thing to think about as we do the work too. So one of the problems there's a problem with the word trauma. I think that trauma has become kind of one of those buzzwords that we hear everywhere and everybody's talking about. And the reality is that we've all experienced some type of trauma, either in our personal lives or in working with these client groups. So I think that the reality is that trauma is everywhere, but what trauma is really just imbalance in the system. It's not that you're damaged goods. It's not that you're a bad person. It's not that your life is terrible and it's always going to be that way. It's imbalance. And how do we correct imbalance with rebalancing? And I think that that's important to state. So doctors in an emergency room have a different definition of trauma than we do. They define it as an insult or wound to the physical body. Well, is trauma that we experience psychologically also that? Yeah, it is a wound to the physical body. It is dysregulation, but it looks different. So that's one word, trauma. For attachment focus experts, it's failure to provide secure attachment environment. It increases disorganized attachment and greater vulnerability to adversity. So we have attachment trauma. I think that attachment trauma is huge. It's an unseen trauma. It's a trauma that people come into your office and they're like, there's nothing bad that's ever happened to me. But as you dig deeper and you look at the story, you find out that maybe mom was hospitalized for 6 months during the early infancy. Maybe they moved around a lot. Maybe they lost a caregiver, but they don't remember that. Maybe they had somebody that was substance use during their early childhood who was in and out of their life, not just physically, but also emotionally and mentally. So I think that we're finding that the impact of attachment trauma is actually bigger than what we may have thought. And it's really hard for people to spot, because if that's the way that they're hardwired to think relationships go, like, they're like, there's nothing wrong. That's the way my family's always operated. That's the way we've always been. So it's really hard intergenerationally to sometimes catch this stuff as you work through it. Developmental focus experts define it as a constant or repeated exposure to adversity through youthful development. So adversity can mean a lot of different things. Adversity can mean that you're living in a neighborhood, that you have a great family. Your family's wonderful, you're tight, you're good, your mom's been there, your dad's been there, everybody's been a support to you. But you live in a neighborhood that's rough, you know, that the struggle is out there on the street every time you walk out your door. It could be that you're exposed to other adversity, you know, job loss, constant moves, things that are challenging within the family. It could be that you're not necessarily the target of any physical violence or emotional neglect or disrespect, but that somebody in your family is, and you're witnessing that. Also, we find that kids that will kind of put themselves in situations where they're exposed to more adversity through their friendship groups, through their social groups, through the people that they connect with. So those are all things to keep in mind.
So bullying would be an example of developmental focused adversity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that also, you know, I think that having a disability.
Yeah.
You know, having a disability, that the stigma that comes with that,
oh, yeah,
growing up with that. People that have cognitive disabilities, or, you know, that struggle with unseen disabilities. People that are on the spectrum, that, you know, that they look normal, but they have other stuff going on, and the way that they react to other people react to them. So adversity is not one-off events. It's a whole experience of being that. Unfortunately, social media has been a way to provide kids with lots of adversity, to be cyberbullied, to be, you know, ridiculed and made fun of and picked on, and to be vulnerable to that. So, you know, we're seeing adversity coming from areas that are non-traditional areas that we wouldn't have thought of before. You know, we think about these big environmental things, but what is the environment that their online connections or that their media connections create for them in terms of adversity? So yeah, so thank you for raising that. I think that's a good point. And you know, a lot of people that are bullied will meet a lot of your criteria for, you know, for having had a serious traumatizing experience. When the body's activated over and over and over again by threat, by fear, and it has to go into that fight, flight, freeze mode, a lot of things can trigger that. And bullying is 100% one of those. The dread of going to school every day. The dread of, what if they notice me? How do I hide? How do I confront this? So yeah, definitely. I would definitely put that in there. And that's developmental. So that's developmental trauma. Psychiatrists and mental health professionals often define trauma as a collection of an emotional, behavioral, and cognitive symptoms related to a significant event. I think we're moving away from that, but a lot of times they will still ask you that. I've been in psychiatric assessments where they've asked, you know, one of my clients, you know, did something bad happen to you in childhood? And I'm like, really? but it's important, but it's not just significant events. They're not thinking about what it was like to wake up every morning and have nobody up except for you and have to get yourself ready for school because mom has passed out. You know, they're not thinking about what these other kind of factors, ongoing, everyday living, walking into the fridge and having nothing to eat. You know, these are things that are real. And I think we're starting to get a little bit better at, you know, trying to figure these things out. But I think neglect a lot of time goes unseen, even in our diagnostics. And when we're starting work with our clients, is we're not really thinking about that. We're not really thinking about asking, you know, did you have access to food? Did you get enough sleep? How many people were living in your house? Was it 10 people in one room? I mean, I remember going into clients' houses where they had three generations of people living in one room. And that was real. that was what it was like if you were in the social welfare system in that borough in London. That's what it was. So, I mean, I think that these are kind of, we're moving away from the one event model, but it still is there. So you will still see it when other people are kind of looking at an individual. So we kind of went into this a little bit, but if you have experienced what we call childhood trauma, these are some of the things that you might have grown up with. And some of these things you'll know about, some things you'll not know about, some things happen before words for our clients, some things they're so used to seeing within their culture, their family, that they don't even seem foreign. This is just the way it is. But recurrent emotional abuse, recurrent sexual abuse, emotional and physical neglect, which is kind of what I went into. And I think emotional neglect is also one that goes unseen. You know, if you have a parent that's working three jobs to try and make ends meet, and, you know, you're not really having any contact with them, you're not probably getting the emotional support that you need, especially if you're having any adverse issues or struggles or something like that. And it's not by any fault of their own. They're doing what they need to do to provide for the family, to not have the physical neglect. But sometimes, given our circumstances, the emotional neglect happens. Physical abuse and harsh corporal punishment. And that's not just, you know, like a spanking or a slap on the wrist. We're talking about like real, legit, harsh corporal punishment. Adults that are substance users. So this can be off and on substance users. This can be full blown. That includes alcoholics. Because they provide the same inconsistent environment that our substance users do. And they're finding that alcoholism is prevalent to the point where a lot of kids are growing up with parents that are alcoholics, and they may not have full-blown trauma symptomology, but there's certain things interacting relationally, the lack of trust, the not being able to count on people, the hypervigilance. See a lot of hypervigilance, you know, tracking. Are you drunk? Are you going to drink? What's going on right now? That kind of environment has created. Caregivers that are in and out of prison and or hospital. So that can include, you know, physical ailments, or it can include, you know, mental health treatment. Adults with mental illness, adults who are physically or emotionally abusive to each other, and when are both parents not present. That doesn't mean that somebody raised by grandparents can't be successful, or aunts or uncles or something like that, but it's just the lack of a consistent kind of caregiver, or feeling like the caregiver doesn't want them, love them, need them, that they're not worth being around, and that's kind of more what that's kind of speaking to. We're finding more and more that we have secondary trauma. So, you know, being around these people is actually just as bad as them doing the things to you. It creates the same level of symptomology and also powerlessness. So I think that that's really important to keep in mind too. And I know that everybody here is working in different environments with different people, but it sounds like everybody's community-based. So I think that this is a great model of the community environment. So it's not just your environment in your house. It's the whole community. What's your social cultural environment? Are there damaged social networks? Are there good social networks and connections? What is the elevation of destructive or dislocating social norms? What is the norm in your culture? What is the norm for caregiving? What is the norm of what a child's role is versus a parent's role? What is your expectation as you move into adulthood within your community, within your culture? You know, where does that lie? And also a low sense of collective political and social efficacy. So how disempowered do your people, do your family, do you feel within society? So this isn't kind of a bigger one. Then we go into the physical place. So this is much more what you're going to see in terms of how safe is your place. Are they living in a deteriorated environment that's unhealthy and where there's often dangerous public spaces or something that's not built well and unhealthy products? So, you know, a lot of times we'll go into environments, especially when you look at kind of Section 8 or public housing, where they've given them a place to live. But some of these places are really, really rough. You know, I wouldn't want to live in them. They're bad. And they're a roof over their head. Yes, we've got them a roof over their head. But they're infested with cockroaches. They have mice. I was in one house where, you know, I was leaving, actually, the client's house, and I got pulled over. And I'm like, I wasn't doing anything wrong. And the policeman said, you know, what are you doing here? And I showed him my card, and I said, you know, hey, I'm visiting a client. And I said, you know, why? And he's like, because the only person that would drive a car that was the model year that you have would be coming in this neighborhood to buy drugs. And he said, I would advise you not to visit your client here. And I said, why? And he said, well, last night there was two shootings in the canal right behind their house. So this family has a home, but this is what their home environment, this is what their neighborhood is like. And so I think that these are important. And I would have never known that. They would have come into my office every week, and we would have had our conversation, and they would have told me everything was probably good, and, you know, yeah, they had food that week, and things are, you know, okay. But I would not have known, because they were so used to being in that environment that it wasn't foreign to them. That was the norm. That was the norm in the house. The norm is that, you know, you get up and you smash the cockroaches, or you, you know, you take care of it. And if somebody gets shot, you try not to look at the dead body. And, you know, that's kind of the way it is. And so I think that, you know, this is real, especially as we work with different populations across, you know, Maricopa County and in different regions, that you may not even know that this is going on. I'd probably driven by that neighborhood 100 times on my way to the freeway and never knew that that was what it was like two blocks over. So I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. That kind of fits really well with the economic and educational environment and opportunity. And the cool thing is that all you guys are here because you're providing opportunity. So I'm like, yay. But the opportunities, and this is why you are here, is because the opportunities for a lot of these people are really limited. The idea, you know, there's long-term unemployment. There's relocation of businesses and jobs. There's limited employment. They perceive there not being any jobs available to them. And that's when you get to the disinvestment. You also have intergenerational poverty. So that's kind of just what I was speaking to, that idea that this is how we live, this is, you know, how we'll continue to live, and this is our struggle, but, you know, we're good with that. And this is, you know, this is the way things are. So I think that all of these things, as we look at people, the community environment builds on all three of these different things and how they interplay together. You might be good in one of the areas, but have a struggle in one of the other areas. And you might have overlap with challenges in all of the areas. And a lot of these things are hard to gauge from people. It's really hard to find out. And I think that, you know, without being intrusive and digging for information, the way that we gather this information needs to be sensitive. It needs to be sensitive to their, and you know, their experience. That we need to ask questions, you know, that are not, you know, do you live in a rundown house with, you know, cockroaches? But, you know, hey, you know, what is it like when you go home? What is the environment like? You know, how does everybody, you know, do you guys sit down for meals? You can ask different questions that will get to the same information should they choose to divulge it without being intrusive. And I think that that's important. A lot of people's experiences of services is people coming in and asking for things, doing things, and telling you what to do. And that's not where people want to be, and that's not how people believe and earn the ability to trust you, but also to feel empowered. So I think that that's an important thing that we need to keep in mind, is how do we empower the honesty and how do we build trust? And it takes time, especially with communities where the mistrust is towards the system, is towards you, is towards anybody coming in to their environment as an outsider trying to build a relationship. So trauma is super common. You know, if we think of it from all those experiences and witnessing things and being part of things, 1 in 7 of all California babies born between 2006 and 2007 has been reported for abuse or neglect by age 5. This is an old statistic, but this lets you know how real this is. I was listening to some statistics earlier today that said that 20% of households, there is somebody abusing drugs. 50% of households, there's somebody abusing alcohol. So this lets you know, these experiences of coming into these environments, even as a baby, it's really real. And in the statistics are from California, because as we go through the ACEs study is from California. But and California is actually a really wide population sample, so it's a nice one to be able to gather from, because you have the inner city populations as well as kind of the more spread out populations and the affluent populations. So you get a really good spread when you're looking at kind of California demographics that you might not get in other states where there's a high metropolitan population or a high rural population. So it's kind of a good counterpoint. Plus, we're right next door. So, you know, some of the struggles, the issues that you see culturally, we're a similar mix. And also, you know, our neighborhoods are set up kind of in a similar way. So you see, you know, when you go into inner city areas in Phoenix, they're going to look similar to inner city areas in a lot of places in California, too, just because we had the same spread. And a lot of the gang activity and stuff has come over from California and has kind of nested in our communities here. So that's something to keep in mind also. But 25% of Californians report 2 to 3 adverse childhood experiences. So I'm going to go ahead and come around, and I'm going to pass out these. What you picked up at the beginning, I kind of explained, was what I like to say is that the nice kind of clean version of the ACEs. This is like the full-blown official Center from Disease Control version of the ACEs. I'm going to give you a choice as to which one you want to fill out, which one feels more approachable to you. And I also want you, when you look at both of them, to think about if you are a client, which one you would want to fill out, and to keep that in mind. I feel like forms are designed for adult researchers. A lot of them, and they're really not child or youth or general population friendly. The good thing about the ACEs is it's a very short measure. So I'm going to go ahead and have you guys fill out whatever one you prefer now, and then we're going to continue to talk about the ACEs. I'm going to show you a little bit of video and background on it. But I like you to see it before I talk about it, so then you can see actually what we're talking about. Also, think about what you experience in your body as you answer these questions. Are there any questions that make your heart race, that make you feel uncomfortable, that you feel like you don't want to answer? And hold that in mind. You can also mark the ones that you don't like or that make you feel uncomfortable or that give you a body response. And there might be certain ones that trigger you more than other ones. And I think for the people that are joining us remotely, hopefully you will have been emailed a copy of this so you can pull it up and look at it as well. I'm starting to see people finish up. As you finish up, I just want you to kind of check in with yourself, check in with your body, your brain, how you feel, having answered those questions, having thought about those questions, and also thinking about how they would feel for a client. I also want you to, as you finish, observe the energy in the room right now. What does it feel like if you were completing this as a group with kids or adults or anybody else? How would it feel? How would that energy be in the room with them? Especially taking into account that they might have higher ACE scores than you do. They might have the same.
On here that I couldn't even answer because I want to say being like a first generation, my parents came here, it was not normal for us to say that you were depressed or anything like that. So like number 9 on defining your ACE score, it says, was a household member depressed or mentally ill? To be honest, I thought my dad was, but I really couldn't tell because he was not diagnosed.
Yep.
So I can't even say if I answer that for him or not.
Yeah.
So there's like a couple other questions that I'm like, kind of triggered me to like, oh really, this is what I really lived through.
Yeah, and you know, this this measure is offered in different languages. So if your clients are first language, a different language, especially Spanish, I would be interested to look at what it looks like in their language, in whatever that language is. Because the words that might be used might be better, worse, confusing. So it's very interesting to also look at this culturally. But thank you for sharing that. Because in a lot of cultures, we don't diagnose mental illness. I mean, it's not something that we refer to. It's something that, you know, so-and-so has had a hard time, they're a little down, you know, they're struggling or whatever it may be. But it's thought of differently. So, you know, this idea of depression is a very white, you know, American term. A lot of other cultures might look at it as a, you know, something you go through in a life cycle, especially if they're challenging events. They don't necessarily diagnose it. They might work with it differently too. So I think that that's a really good point to point out. And you know, how do we introduce it then to people that we know that are working with that are culturally different? And this is part of that trauma-informed piece, is like, how do we introduce this questionnaire to make people feel safe answering it? And I provided very little instruction because I wanted everybody to see what it would be like if you, because a lot of times we do this as clinicians, we hand somebody a questionnaire and we're like, go for it. We haven't done it for ourselves, one. And two, we might have not provided enough instruction, enough safety in the environment to be able to answer this. We might have provided this in a group setting at the end of a session where, you know, then everybody's walking out the door having thought about all this stuff and possibly been triggered. So beautiful.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to come from like a school teacher perspective on this. And I definitely think it's short form than this thing. But, but even then, I'm thinking like, you know, does this form come with a consideration for Lexile levels? Because the individuals, you know, their literacy ability or whatnot can impact how they answer some of these questions. Because, you know, I'm just looking to say, if you give them the big form, what is your civic status, for example? I know what that is. I'm pretty sure everybody in this room knows what that is. But if you're working with somebody who's reading at like a third grade level,
exactly,
you know, haven't been in school for a long time, they're not going to know what that is. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are other questions on here. So I mean, that alone can impact how they answer these questions. Because they're not going to admit, they're going to be like, well, I don't know what civic status is.
Yeah.
They're just going to circle something.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think that's a great point. How do we make this form, how do we make this as a tool accessible? How do we create an environment that's safe to question it? Because, you know, when we present a form, it's like the authority. And, you know, our clients feel like it's the authority thing. And then they feel maybe ashamed. they feel triggered just by the form, right? Not even by the material that's on the form. Dang, I don't know that word. That's the first word on that survey. I'm stupid. I can't fill this out. I don't want to do it. So 100%, yes. How do we look at the vocabulary that's used on the forms and paperwork that we give our client? Beautiful, thank you.
My question was in the definition of household when I read some of these. I grew up in a rural community and my mom's the second oldest of 14. Mm-hmm. And while some of these things didn't happen in my direct family union, when you live in a small town and you have multiple extended family members.
Yeah.
But when I kept reading the questions, it's like, did your parents do this? And I was like, well, no, but my uncle did. And I saw that continuously and constantly in family settings, but it wasn't my parents. So how someone may have, I think that may have lowered my score, where if I had answered them in terms of extended household family, my scores probably would have been up.
And I think that community piece is, you know, when we were looking at those circles, that wider community piece is really important. And it may not directly impact your E-score, but knowing that from a secondary perspective, that that's what you were surrounded by is super important. And sometimes we don't think about that. And we don't kind of take that into account.
Personally, I really appreciated the larger form, because it kind of expanded on that topic and exactly what you were looking at. Being the child of a military man, one of these questions was kind of like, were your parents ever separated or divorced? Well, my parents were married for over 60 years, but being a military man, my dad was absent from the household. When he went TDY, when he went to Vietnam for a year, which was a scary thing.
You
don't know if they're coming back.
Of course.
So they remained together their entire marriage, but there were separations. And just if you look at that on the face value, it's like, well, how do I answer that? But that definitely did have an impact as a child.
I want to go back to the household thing. I think that also brings up a cultural question, because what culture are we talking about when we say household? I mean, you've got like kind of your, say, typical, you know, American definition as mom, dad, kids, but for other cultures, the household is like, you don't have to live under the same roof. It's the cousins, grandma, you know, uncles, aunts, you know, and if not just one spot.
And we also, you know, although people say that we're moving away from it, there's still a lot of community care within families. There's still a lot of, you know, interchangeable care where, you know, you might go to your tia or your aunt's house for the, you know, after school every day. Or, you know, you might go to your grandma's, you know, on the weekend, you know, if your mom's working a job that she has to work on the weekend, you know, or your dad has this going on or whatever it may be. There's still a lot of care in our communities that happens within extended family members. There's also a lot of trauma and abuse that happens with extended family members. I often see more in my work where the sexual, you know, the children that have experienced sexual abuse has been with an extended family member, not necessarily with the immediate family, has been with a cousin, with an aunt, with an uncle. So I think that a grandparent, something like that. And as we have families and extended families and step families and people that we call family and how that all comes together, it's really these interactions with the bigger family. And, you know, the household might change. If you have, you know, your mom's sister living with you for, you know, 3 years, the household's different. It's not just your mom. It changes. If you have people coming in and out, if you have a, you know, a father or a mother that has multiple partners that are coming in and out of the household is changing. And we're seeing more of that as we see, you know, families where there's a lot of, you know, divorce, separation, you know, that there's children that are born, you know, out of marriage or out of, you know, coupling or whatever that might be, that's something to think about too. I think that's a really good point.
I'm thinking for the youth that I deal with, and so I'm not familiar with ACE, but I would want to know, like, when is this given and what's the purpose? Because I feel like a lot of my youth in situations are never upfront at first, and it definitely takes a long time for them to trust me, or sometimes it just comes out of nowhere and, you know, they just need to talk. But I feel like they would feel very uncomfortable answering these questions if they didn't feel safe, and I think most of the time they don't feel safe. So I don't think that they would answer, or this would set them off, you know. So I guess from my understanding, I'm trying to understand, when does this happen and how do we know that they feel safe and what's the purpose of it? Because I think those are all the things that they would think. They just wouldn't, I don't see them opening up unless they felt safe, and that doesn't just happen.
We're going to talk more about why we do this and why the information is gathered. You can choose to do it at any time.
Yeah.
A lot of people choose to do it at the beginning because they introduce it as a psychoeducational piece to talk about, you know, risk and where you're at and how you can move forward, how you can be able to kind of take what you've been given from a childhood perspective and move into adulthood and create resilience. So it's a piece in that thing. It also allows sometimes for people to start thinking about how their behavior now might have been a result of having had these experiences. Not because they're bad, not because they're evil, not because they're not a good person, not because they're a screw up, but because they went through some serious stuff and their ACE score is high. Doesn't mean we cannot fix them. It doesn't mean we cannot build resilience, but they need to know that if they do not invest in the piece to build, to work forward, to move forward, that they have a lot of stuff that they can come up against.
I agree. So do you think this would be best? So we help people with their goals, right? Pertaining to work on education, but when we're working with opportunities or foster youth, that mental health is, it has to do with everything, right? And that, but like I was saying, a lot of times because we're focusing on goals and trying to just kind of gain their trust and letting them open up at their own time, but I see how this could open up the conversation right away, whether it happens or not, you know, that's situational. But you think this would be best right at the beginning of meeting, of like before
you I think generally it's used as a diagnostic tool. It doesn't mean you can't go back and do it. It doesn't mean you can't, you know, if you're getting a lot of people that, you know, you feel like there's a lot of dissociation and they're not like at all engaging in how, you know, things might have kind of come into where they're at right now and what their journey has been. That I think is, you could do, you know, later on down the piece. If you have a group that you've never done this with, you can do it later. I mean, you can do it with, you know, if you have a family, with the parents of, you know, who you're working with, and to find out what they're coming from intergenerationally. I think that that's interesting, an interesting piece as well. I always tell people, you don't have to share it. This is for you. This is to figure out, you know, where we're coming at from a baseline. Like, you know, you don't have to share this with me. You don't have to share this with anybody in there. In fact, if you don't want to look at it ever again, you can throw it away. Like, you know, this is just for you to think about where you're coming into this piece of work and us setting goals together to really make you amazing and to really build these skills inside of you. You can also choose not to use it, but I think that, you know, it's just something that you're going to see a big shift in terms of the way that everybody, I mean, as you can see, they're referring to children's exposure to ACEs as the greatest unaddressed public health threat of our time. So the research behind this is really strong, and I'm going to walk you through the research, and I'm going to talk about it, and we're going to look at, you know, how this affects people. But for a lot of people that are not in touch with this, they feel a lot of blame and shame about where they're at right now, about why they're not good enough, about why their behaviors are getting them into trouble. And this allows an ability to see it from a different lens. That, hey, your brain was wired this way because this is what you were going through. And now we have an opportunity to rewire. Let's do it. You know, so I think that it just comes where you build it. If you build it from a capacity building point of view versus a you're doomed and, you know, like, look at, you got a four. Like, you know, like, what, you know, what are you going to do?
A lot of medication, they're medicated, and sometimes that causes other problems. So I think.
Mm-hmm. And the coolest thing is that, you know, like, what we're going to talk about is the whole idea of the ACEs is about how we build resilience then. And resilience is something you can build. You don't need medication for resilience. So that's cool. So, you know, you can connect this, but you have to bring that message. And you also have to create safety in the environment that you're giving it. So you might not want to do it the first session that you meet somebody. You might want to do something else. This might be too much. So that's something to keep in mind.
I think an issue with issue that we have with the youth and being sometimes, or in most cases, working with minors is being a mandated reporter. And so there's that fine line where it's like, okay, you want to gain their trust, but if they tell you that, you know, in one instance, you know, a young girl told me that her stepfather was basically, you know, raping her, I can't, you know, because of my job and other things, I couldn't really keep that quiet.
Yeah.
But then again, I felt like I was betraying her trust because she told me this, you know, this is between me and you. And so it's just kind of that fine line as to how do you really tell them, you know what, thank you for trusting me. However, you know, in order for you to be safe, I need to report this. And I don't think they understand that part.
And I think one of the key parts is, you know, when you set up to do this work, to do this piece, to do any of this, that you are very transparent. One of the things that we've done in it, that we haven't done with trauma-informed care is we haven't laid everything out. We haven't laid out our purpose. If your purpose from to use the ACEs is to then use it as a building block to move forward and create resilience, you need to let them know that. If they feel like you're doing this to gather information and dig dirt on them, that's a different type of feeling.